our culture has been able to afford. The first approach, which seems now somewhat dated, we can call the non-scientific views of the future by the scientific community, which are on the whole optimistic in character. Without making the future an object of scientific inquiry, nevertheless, several scientists have, in the name of the scientific community, tried to tell us what that future may or will be like. These views represent a vision of the future as a large part of the community of physical and social and life sciences have in the past foreseen that future. I'm thinking, for example, of such eminent figures as Julian Huxley, as Theodosius Dobzhansky, Kenneth Boulding, and a host of others who have spoken on the meaning of our time and of its future. Perhaps the main theme of this vision has been its sense of the utterly new situation of humanity in history because of the appearance of science. Now, as they argue, men and women know how at last to know. And hence, they know how to gain the knowledge that can give them control. This is a tradition, of course, that goes back to Francis Bacon, their great-grandfather. What they do not yet know, they will know soon enough. And thus, what we do not yet control, that in the very near future, we will learn how to control. Thus, potentially, and of course in much actually, men and women can now direct for their own ends and purposes the forces that heretofore have determined them from the outside. We can, as Huxley and Dobzhansky reiterate, even take evolution, biological and cultural, into our own hands and make of mankind and of his history a place in which it will be better to live. Knowledge has, therefore, given the human race potential freedom over destiny and certainly over the fates that had heretofore determined life from the outside. Through physical science and technology, men and women can remake their natural environment into a place that serves them. Through biological science and psychology, they can remake themselves into more efficient instruments of their own ends. That's a direct quotation from Huxley. I feel a kind of circular, mysterious, spooky character to the sentence, that we are remaking ourselves into more efficient instruments of our own ends. I don't know, to quote an old phrase, who's doing what to whom under those conditions. We can, through social science, transform our social environment into a more rational society. Thus, controlling nature, society, and themselves through their knowledge, humankind can control their own destiny at last, if they will. Of course, men and women may choose to act foolishly and greedily, but at least in the present, with the advent of science, it is now at last up to us. Knowledge, one may say here, has transformed destiny not into fate, but into an arena of almost total freedom. A new historical eon is upon us, dominated now for the first time by human choice, and so one in which human virtue, human objectivity, human tolerance, human responsibility are more important than ever. Here surely is the perfectionist optimism of the 18th century, rendered up to date by donning a white coat. Two aspects immediately impress the more cynical, or if you will, the more Calvinistic observer of these views of history and of the future. First of all, that human problems in history are understood here without much discussion, one may say, are understood to be predominantly problems in knowledge, in how much we know. And therefore, in knowing more, we are able to control more and our problems recede. So that radically more knowledge means a radically new history. This is, one may say, in the tradition of our studies, a modern form of Gnosticism, and in that sense, typically academics. Most professions find the solution to basic human problems arising out of their own capacities. Academics are no different from anybody else at this point, and thus they see problems in terms of what they do best, that is knowing, and they see an increase of knowledge as the salvation of the human race. But while it is, secondly, that while it is recognized that freedom is not utterly dependable, we may choose wrong with all this power, still the main issue in history is, so to speak, that of freeing freedom, of rescuing men and women from destiny and from fate, from that which controls them from the outside. If we can, so to speak, put men and women and not chance in control of what happens, humans can create a new world. The sense that the real problems of history may arise from the human inability or apparent inability to control themselves, and thus is not so much the lack of their power to control of knowledge as it is their misuse of it, does not appear in any way in any of these views. In any case, it is interesting to note that when the scientific community, at least through these spokesmen, views history from the perspective of its own community and its powers, it sees history not at all as essentially determined by blind, necessitating laws and factors, as that same community is apt to see nature, or as it sees society and the self in other contexts. Rather, here scientists see history, that is, a history dominated by science and the scientific community, as a realm of almost unconditioned freedom, and thus a realm of infinite possibilities of the new in history. Here history, one may say, has science as its predominant subject, as the creative force within history, not science, history as its object. And thus everything in the future can be different from the past. History is wide open and has a utopian character. The history here, so portrayed, the future, is, it seems to me, utterly unreal. This is a real mythology with a modern Indra in a white coat creating order out of the chaos of the past and making of man's destiny what he will. Theologians have looked at these views with some skepticism for some time, but one may say the real disproof has come from the community that we're referring to. For recently, science has begun to give us an entirely different view of the future, in this case, one of intense gloom. In a world of depleted and shrinking resources, in a world of expanding population, we are told, freedom will not at all increase and will, in fact, be less secure than ever. Rather, we can look forward to the radical control of technology in order that survival be possible. We can look forward to authoritarian governments capable of effecting this control on technological expansion, and not only controlling technological expansion, but in fact reducing it. We can look forward, the social scientists say, to violent social conflict in a world where standards of living begin to recede or to diminish rather than to increase. And one can think what would happen in this country with all its poverty if the hope of a raising standard of living were to be lifted, not to mention the relation of the have nations in the world to the have-nots and the implications of authoritarian government in order to maintain the peace under those conditions. We can look forward to the visible loss of freedom and the reappearance of domination. If you wish to feel really bad about the future, I suggest, if you're feeling somewhat masochistic, in other words, I suggest that you read Robert Heilbrunner's piece in the New York Review of Books in January 25th, 1974, called The Human Prospect. You have to have, I must say this, a large drink at your side, or else you'll spend a most dismal evening. One may say that the irony of this is that truly a faith in man, the creator of historical destiny, has in our time turned to despair that man is not the creator of his destiny, but he is now the victim of an implacable fate. And the irony of this is that the fate is self-created. If one wishes to feel the deep ambiguity of history, it is that probably the largest signal of the freedom of man over his destiny, namely technology and the development of science, has become, in this present scientific view that I'm referring to, the fate that is finally going to destroy him, or threatens so to do. In any case, the scientific community speaks to us about the future with two quite different voices, one utopian, one despairing. And I think that a Christian has got to take both of these voices with some seriousness. The possibilities of creativity in the future as in the past, the possibilities of a fated and dismal future as also there. This, it seems to me, has been the character of human history since the beginning, and a profound faith has been there to deal precisely with this character of history. One may say that religion is by no means rendered irrelevant in the future of a scientific culture, but that the ambiguity of science, as has always been there with the ambiguity of human power in any form, has merely increased as history has moved forward, and the dealing with that ambiguity in terms of morals, in terms of courage, and in terms of confidence is going to be as deep, if not deeper, an issue of the future for which the churches will be responsible as it ever has been. One can just think of the ethical or unethical possibilities of a situation of really depleted resources for a country with remaining power, and the terrible temptation to take over those sources as that depletion becomes more real. If there will be a task for Christian preaching in the next 50 years, it will be to prevent us, in relation to the other great powers, from grabbing what is left so that we may briefly maintain our affluent existence as the rest of the race goes down. One can picture the judgment of God on that kind of scene, and it's not a pretty picture. There's still a task for the church. In any case, on the reflective level, what one misses in these views is a discussion of the kinds of issues that we were raising last time, a discussion of the relation of destiny and fate in history, of those things we cannot control that come to us out of the past, to human freedom, and on the character of human freedom, its possibilities, its temptations, and its falls, and the hope of renewal, that this is very much involved in the whole question of the meaning of the future. And so I would like to turn now to the philosophy of history in our time to see what the philosophers are saying about these problems. So now let us turn to philosophical reflection on history. This is, as I have just argued, necessary if we are to understand history, even if we are to understand it scientifically. And it is, as I will argue all along, utterly essential for a theological view of history and its hopes. Theology must use philosophy if it is to make itself clear to itself. When we look at philosophy of history in our time, two very diverse groups dominate the scene. What are called the critical philosophers of history in North America and in England, and the Marxists in the rest of the world. One may laugh or cry at that remark, but don't. It's probably true. History as a word has always had two different but interrelated meanings. It can, that is the word history, can refer to the objective course of events in which humans live and about which they may inquire, the history, so to speak, that historians write about, or it can refer to that inquiry itself, to human knowledge and understanding of that course of events, the history that historians write. The first meaning, namely history as the course of events reflected upon in philosophy, results in what is called speculative or metaphysical philosophy of history, an attempt to understand that total course of events with regard to its fundamental patterns, if any, its basic dynamic and causative factors, and its goal or meaning, if there be one. Here, philosophy is to history as science is to nature, that is, an effort to uncover the rational structure of history, its patterns of change, its most fundamental form and goal. There are many names associated with this kind of inquiry, of course. One thinks of Herder, one thinks of Kant, one thinks especially of Hegel, one thinks of Karl Marx, of Spengler, of Toynbee, and so on and so forth. And contemporary Marxism, as I've remarked, is probably the most potent form of this form of philosophy of history. In the Anglo-Saxon world, in England and America, this kind of philosophy of history has been wildly out of fashion. And most philosophical reflection on history has been dominated by the other type, that is, by critical philosophy of history. That is, by reflection on human knowledge of history, what sort of knowledge it is, and especially how that knowledge is related to science and the modes of knowing of science. This is to historical inquiry what philosophy of science is to science. Philosophy of science doesn't tell us what nature is like, but what science is like. So here, philosophy of history doesn't tell us what history is, but what historical knowledge is. This does not mean that what critical philosophy of history has said is at all trivial or uninteresting in itself or to us. Though, as I shall try to note rather briefly, it seems to me at least, much like the scientific views of history just dealt with, to leave unreflected upon a vast number of important issues. In any case, the main subjects of discussion are of great concern to us here. I'll mention two. First of all, the question, what is a historical explanation? Is it like science in terms of general laws? Is it in terms of the conditions or causes necessary for a particular event to happen? For example, the event of the First World War. Is it a matter of understanding or uncovering the motives or intentions or even the moral concerns of the people involved in the event? Or is it a question of bringing to light the massive hidden social factors, economic, technological, cultural, racial, and so forth, that may lie back of the event and what the actors in it did? Such debates obviously are important for theology. For theology, if it's going to speak about the providence of God, must get into this discussion of what makes what happen in history. Here, these debates are empirically conducted, that is, by examining what historians in fact do to explain an event. But these issues are at base, I would suggest, ontological in character, reaching for the fundamental factors or causes at work in historical change, an issue which historians can hardly avoid in their work, but which is surely not a direct object of the historian's reflection. Debate is also centered about the potential objectivity of history as a form of inquiry. Can the historian discover what really happened, the actual facts? Or is the reconstruction of the historian so determined by their values, by their Weltanschauung, by their own view of social and historical change, that the history that historians write reveals more of their own perspectives and the perspectives of their time than it does of their object, As one may say that Gibbon's great account of the fall of Rome tells us as much about the 18th century in which Gibbon wrote as it does about the Roman Empire itself. And if we grant that another age has a vastly different worldview than our own and different values, how are we to understand what they said or why they did what they did, that is, their texts, so as to lose neither the integrity or uniqueness, the difference from us of what they said, nor our sense of its relevance and significance, the continuity with what we think and are. Here the historical problem of interpreting past facts merges with the hermeneutical problem of a text and its interpretation, and the relevance of these discussions in critical philosophy of history to theology and its concerns with its own history, and above all with the texts that come out of the past, the scripture, becomes self-evident. I am, however, inclined to agree with both Tillich and with Pannenberg, among others, that critical philosophy of history and hermeneutical philosophy, a large subject of present theology, if restricted to reflection on the problems of historical and hermeneutical inquiry alone, remain abstractions whose implicit and yet effective presuppositions about history and its changes is as yet unclarified, and so which call, if they are to be intelligible at all, for a more fundamental philosophy of history. And so let us now turn, since the proof of that point is a complex and difficult one, to philosophers of history, speculative philosophers of history, who discuss these issues. The most important form of speculative philosophy of history in our age, as I've said, that is a serious, reflective attempt to understand the nature of the course of history as the basis for intelligent action within history, is unquestionably Marxism. In our country, the intellectual elite, unlike the rest of the population, has not regarded Marxism as unclean or as essentially blasphemous, and therefore totally undiscussable, but merely as obviously wrong, as an ideology, and thus not worthy of serious discussion. This is, I think, a vast mistake. One cannot, I hazard, understand mature European intellectual life without Marxism any better than you can understand mature American intellectual life without Freudianism. And almost no younger thinker or student in Western Europe but is even more influenced by these categories. And the significance of this philosophy is even greater elsewhere than it is in Europe. One may say that our attitude is somewhat like the attitude of non-Christians to Christianity, who take Catholicism at its worst as the paradigmatic form of Christianity and thus dispose of the whole thing. We're inclined to take Stalinism as the form of Marxism and thus not to carry on a reflective discussion. This attitude, it seems to me, is parochial, unrealistic, and extremely dangerous. The most influential Marxist philosopher in Europe, Marcuse possibly excepted, has been, I believe, Ernst Bloch. His influence on contemporary European theology and through that on American theology has been immense. And it is the measure of the parochialism of our own philosophy departments in this country that Bloch's thought has come to us, like that of Martin Heidegger, through his theological interpreters. We shall isolate only a few themes in Bloch which directly relate to our own theme and to the theologians he has influenced. The first is his interesting and radical rejection of empiricism and verificationism, the notion that thought to be significant and true must accommodate itself to the visible and so present facts, a dogma of our present academic life. On the contrary, says Bloch, almost all important thought, religious, philosophical, and social, has done just the opposite. It has implicitly or explicitly sought to present to us what is not the facts, the not yet, what might be, the ideal that is not yet actual. It has presented to us utopia. These daydreams, these visions, these theologies of messianism, these ontologies of pure being in philosophy have for him been crucial to historical process simply because they did not represent what was presently the facts. Creative thought, he says, should direct rather than be directed by the facts. The purpose of thought is to transform the given, not to be conformed to it. And thus is the ideal possibility the most important object of thought. And thus, through that, is the new in history possible at all. As he remarks, the statement, 1,000 years of injustice do not justify 1 hour of injustice, is an insight so little in accord with the facts of history that all it did was to start the British, the American, and the French, and the Russian revolutions. He is also critical in part of Marx for being too scientific, too materialistic, in fact, too bourgeois, as he says, for concentrating on the economic and political understanding of man, which is important, but leaving the human, the soul of the human being out. The point of all political reform, argues Bloch, is to develop the inwardness, the spirituality, the ultimate concern of human beings. And this Marx quite forgot. The spirit or the soul is the only locus of value in mankind. Marxism, as he puts it, is a social and political philosophy in need of inward humanistic development. Thus, the essential nature of historical men and women and of their world is process for Bloch. The movement into what is not yet the case, what might be but is not. To understand in terms of what is to miss the whole point, humanly, ontologically, and historically. The essence of something is only what it can and will be, its fulfillment. The essence of man and of history is only what they can become. The hidden aim or in truth of religious myth and of theology, of philosophical speculation and of literature, is to portray in images what is not but what can be, the ideal utopia that is the real essence of what is given to us. Thus, the future, where what is and might be will be realized, where essences will become manifest, is the most important category of philosophy. And the future determines the present. For all human action, and so the course of history itself, is determined by human intentions and by aims directed at some ideal, by the dreams and images of possibility which human action can realize in the future. Again, as he puts it, what is rectified and reconciled by the future, by utopia. Thought can never and should never seek to refute possibility by present facts. Empiricism is the hidden ideology of conservatism and of fascism, and thus the major ideological tool that a conservative society uses to close out the future. This is a very interesting and radical point, and I suggest that those who've been fighting empiricism in universities for the sake of theology could well get Bloch at their side, and they'll have a very friendly big brother. The main active factor in historical process is subjective, human. Human dreams and utopias expressed in myth, philosophy, and theology, and the hopes for the future which they embody are what makes things happen. An expression as expressions of possibility, religion and ontology and literature are vital to humanity, something materialistic socialism never really understood. Bloch believes and seeks to show in his detailed examinations of myths, of literature, of philosophy and theology, that utopia, unrealized possibility, is the center of cultural creativity and so the dynamic principle of process. These imaged possibilities determine history, for it is on their basis that human action in history and the initiation of the new take place. Thus, through imagined possibilities, the future determines every present. However, there are also objective, external, non-human factors necessary to the future realization of possibility, says Bloch. Though Bloch has not explicated them as clearly as did Marx, who of course explicated a material dialectic to historical process that would bring about the ideal possibility. Bloch refers to these as objective latencies, as trends, as real possibilities in the world around us, what he calls, in an interesting phrase, the cosmic incognito that is bringing about the ideal. As he puts it, the universal formula of philosophy at its beginning is S is not yet P. No subject already has its adequate predicate. The world process has a tendency or latency to realize this essential yet not yet actual nature, an instability to remain in its present desperate state. Hence the future and hope are utterly significant, as is action towards the future and on the grounds of hope. Bloch is a staunch atheist, though more on Feuerbach's than on Marx's terms. For religion for Bloch is radical, not conservative, in its social meaning, and so is essential and creative to human life, a religion that is without God. God, the omnipotent ruler of what is for Bloch not only superstition, but a demon, the enemy of all freedom, of all openness, and of possibility, he who is responsible for the tragedy of the present. Thus, he says, what is needed is a messianic kingdom without God, that is, the hope for an ideal, but one that is solely human in its character. Religion can be creative insofar as it is humanized in this sense, made into the dream of human beings to be realized through men's actions. When the transcendent attributes formerly ascribed to deity, distinguishing deity from the world, are transformed into the future attributes of a kingdom that distinguishes a truly human world from what is now the case. Thus, the sense in traditional religion of mystery, of depth, of possibility, of the sacred, are essential, says Bloch, for creative process. That there is, as he puts it, a sacred space of possibility in the future, and that humans can become divine is the great message of religion. That there is the possibility of human redemption. This is what religion adds, and this is what, for him, the Christ figure means, as the final form of religion, an interesting remark from a Marxist Jew. A figure preaching the coming kingdom and affirming the identity of his own humanity with the deity of God. Bloch is, as I hope you feel, an exciting and inspiring philosopher. His sense of the vast possibilities of human process and of history, of the movement of history into the new, of the dominance of the future, of the mystery and spiritual depth of human being, and so of the sacred character of what is not yet, are very revolutionary, very important and relevant in an age of change, and self-consciously breathe an eschatological spirit. No wonder he has had such influence on modern theology. However, as his theological followers, Pannenberg, Moltmann, Metz, and so on, point out, his atheism, they argue, is inconsistent and crippling to the genius of his own thought and the credibility of his own hopes. What are, they ask, the real grounds for hope in such a view? How can a blind, naturalistically interpreted process be the basis for our hopes for the realization of the good in history, in the conquest of human alienation? Are mere blind latencies enough? And if we count solely on human autonomy and action, and Bloch is very vague at this point, what basis is there for our hopes? Can really alienated man so recreate and redeem himself and his world by himself? As Herbert Marcuse has pointed out, alienated man can become happy and so cease to seek to change things at all, and a new world ceases to be a possibility. Thus, these theologians argue, the sacred space in the future, the objective ground of the not yet that will be someday, that now determines the present, this cannot be left the void that Bloch leaves it but must become God again. Not the traditional God of the past and the present, but the God whose being, like Bloch's possibilities, is future, and who brings in his new world from the future. And thus, out of Father Bloch comes modern futurist eschatological theology in Europe. The last philosopher I shall briefly consider is Whitehead. Although he was not as Bloch directly a philosopher of history or a political philosopher, nevertheless he dealt creatively with many of the same themes and is, as I shall argue later, a better guide in thinking out a theology of history and of eschatology than is Bloch. Reality for Whitehead, as for Bloch, is process, a flux of events rather than the endurance of unchanging substances. Events come to be and pass away, each arising out of its own past, repeating certain characteristics of that past, and thus are there continuities, societies, or things and persons, as we would call them, in the world around us. But each event also enacting or being able to enact a new form, a new possibility. Thus is possibility, what is not yet, central to the understanding of actuality, and one can feel the union between this Marxist and this Edwardian gentleman in England and America, even though their cultures were so different. Possibility is central to the understanding of actuality. Order is there, otherwise there would be no things in our world, and so no vivid experience. But order, says Whitehead, is continually qualified by new possibilities, by novelties, and so by the possibility of higher ranges of order, else the flux be warped and deadened by a mere repetition of what has always been. Thus, as for Bloch, possibility and the new are essential for creative being. But in Whitehead, these arise out of order, in continuity with what has been, rather than in opposition to what has been, as in Bloch. Whitehead is in this sense liberal and providential in his thinking, rather than radical and eschatological in his thinking. Events as they arise conform to their past, and so in part repeat it or manifest the influence of the past. And so the categories of substance and of causality are applicable to our experience. They are affected in this way by their past because, Whitehead says, they feel that past, and in feeling it, they reproduce it in their own being. These conformal feelings of the past, Whitehead calls physical prehensions and causal efficacy. But events also enact new possibilities, new forms not yet characteristic of achieved actuality. Thus, they also have what Whitehead calls conceptual prehensions. They feel and so enact mere possibilities or forms in coming to be. Thus, each event is in as direct relation to what is not yet the case as it is to what is the case. Possibility, change, and novelty are crucial to existence. Events are also free and self-determining. How they feel their past, how much they conform to it, how they feel new possibilities, how much they enact them, these are all finally determined by the entity for itself. We are ultimately determined, says Whitehead, by nothing outside of ourselves, neither by the shape of our inheritance, nor by the objective possibilities of our present. Autonomy and self-creation are thus ingredient in all process, and thus is the future really open, full of possibilities, and full of freedom to enact it. In this metaphysical situation, as Whitehead calls it, there are thus three fundamental and universal factors: creativity, the ongoing flux of events, eternal objects or forms and possibilities for the flux, and the freedom of each entity to create itself out of this its world. So far, we have before us a more universal, subtle, and intricate elaboration of Bloch's general scheme. But, says Whitehead, there must be a further factor present to explain process as we experience it, a factor that he calls God. For he argues possibility must be somewhere in actuality. It can't float in as effective from nowhere, and so there must be some real entity that envisions all of possibility, orders it, and so can relate it to the moving flux of events. Furthermore, we cannot explain the relative order of process, that there are continuing things and persons, unless there is some objective order to the new possibilities that are open to us. Unformed creativity, says Whitehead, plus the infinite realm of possibility, plus the arbitrary freedom of every entity, cannot altogether form a definite world or a world of social order, and especially a world whose increasing value is clear to us. Bloch's latency is not enough. It cannot explain the order we know or provide an objective ground for the hope in the not yet that will be good, which he envisions. Thus, there is an entity, God. The ground of order and so of advance in the novel possibilities in our real moving world. God is dipolar, as are all entities, everlasting and changeless in one of his aspects, changing, developing, and dependent on his world in another aspect. His primordial nature is his conceptual prehension of all possibilities that gives an eternal and changeless order to the moving moments of time. Thus does each event on arising get its appropriate ideal from God. God is the continuing ground for all the novel possibilities of history, possibilities which lead to the achievement of the creative new in life. His consequent nature is God's feeling or prehension or experiencing of all of achieved actuality. Each entity as it has become is prehended by God, influences God's experience, and is thus brought into the everlasting unity of God's life and being. Thus, as Whitehead puts it, nothing that is of value is ever lost, and the passingness and transience of becoming are rescued by the permanence of God's being. This, I think, is a magnificent philosophical vision of process as characterized by both freedom and destiny, change and permanence, novelty and order, and of immense theological relevance. More than Bloch, it provides modes of understanding useful in making intelligible in contemporary terms the nature of historical experience and the modern meaning of many of our biblical symbols. Two problems remain for me with this vision as Whitehead explicated it. For Whitehead, creativity as the flux of things is formed by God, not created or produced by him. He provides the existing flux with its possible forms. He is not the source of that flux. Thus, our experience of our own being is only partly indebted to God. Both our existence and our freedom are elements he merely molds, shapes, or lures. They are not his creatures. But as we saw, our contingent being and our freedom themselves point to ultimacy, and so to their own intrinsic dependence upon God. And this is, I believe, the clear biblical witness in the doctrine of creation as well. Secondly, it is hard, though possibly not impossible, to comprehend the principle of the demonic, of a bound and fallen freedom in Whitehead's universe of orderly advance into novelty, or how God, so understood, can act in radically new ways to redeem a really lost world. Again, these aspects of biblical symbolism on the one hand and of our historical experience on the other seem to me to fit uneasily into this essentially progressivist ontology. Thus, as we shall suggest, Whitehead's thought, like that of Bloch, must be used, not adopted, by theology for its self-understanding. Secular philosophy cannot provide the fundamental visions elucidating our historical experience. For as non-speculative philosophy has emphasized, we do not ourselves yet stand in the place of God at the end of history, and thus its most basic structures, especially about ourselves and our ambiguity, are not yet clear to us. But in clarifying the significant factors of our present, philosophy can illumine and clarify our own fundamental theological or religious symbols by which we may think out the wholeness of experience in all its creativity, its contradictions, and its hopes. And thus we are driven beyond philosophy to embark on the questions of a theological understanding of history.
As we leave this place today, O Lord, may we go with reverent and inquiring minds and hearts. Light our pathway, we pray, with thy light. In Christ's name, amen.